Well, I heard about a little boy who started kindergarten. And he really wanted to impress his mommy and daddy. And so on the first day at kindergarten, he had one of the upperclassmen teach him a part of the multiplication table. And so that night, as he sat at the supper table with his mommy and daddy, this little boy, very first day in kindergarten, said, 2 times 2 equals 4. Well, his mommy and daddy were just amazed. I mean, here their little darling. Just the very first day in kindergarten, he was already multiplying, and what they'd long suspicioned was now confirmed, that they'd given birth to a budding genius. And so as they sat there beaming with pride, the little boy said, "What's a 2? Well, the fact of the matter is, it's easy for us to sound as if we know more than we really do. I have discovered that if a person hangs around long enough, people will begin to think he knows what he's doing. What's even worse, he may get to thinking he knows what he's doing. But it's easy for us, after a while, we've been in a place for a while in a church, it's easy for us to, as we listen to the language, we pick up the terminology and almost unconsciously incorporate that into our own vocabulary, and amazingly, we know just when to bring out the right words and the right phrases. And so we end up talking as if we know a great deal more than we do. And we never really know how much we know until somebody begins to ask us some questions, and then we discover that we really didn't know as much as we thought we did. I never will forget one of my most embarrassing moments. When I was in college, I was the pastor of a little church that I preached at it on the weekend, and so one Monday back at school, when one of our professors would ask the fellows that had preached on the Sunday before what they had preached on. And he asked me, "What did you preach on?" I said, "I preached on the prodigal son." And he said, "Dunn, do you know what the word prodigal means?" I didn't. I didn't have a clue as to what the word prodigal meant. And then he sort of embarrassed me for preaching on something I didn't know the meaning of. And he said, "I suggest you find out the meaning of prodigal before you preach on the prodigal son again. Remind me, Paul, to do that as soon as this service is over. I need to check on that." But you know, for people like many of us who grow up in the church, especially a Baptist church, where you hear certain words and phrases and you pick them up and you begin to use them, even though you may not really know what those words and phrases mean. And I don't think there's any word or category of words that suffer more from this than the word faith or believe or trust. We use phrases like walking with God and living by faith and trusting God, living a life of faith. I don't know how it is with you, but when I was growing up in the church, there was a certain aura attached to those words. And every once in a while, we would have somebody in our church and they would say, "This man lives by faith." And I wasn't certain what that meant, except that he didn't have a salary. Usually what they meant when they said, "This man lives by faith." But there was a certain aura about that. And a certain, you know, mystery. And we would say this idea of this person who is living by faith and knows how to believe God, we would look at them as though they were somebody special. But those were words and terms that were used every week in our church. And you grew up understanding we are saved by grace through faith, and that we're to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, and that we're to trust God, and that we're to have faith. And so, you know, we learn those phrases, we hear those words and terms all our life, and we just assume that we know what they mean. Somebody comes to us during a time of crisis, and they said, "Now, you know, you're just going to have to trust God this time." "Okay, I'm going to trust God." Wonder what that means. I've always assumed I knew what it meant. And I've told others they had to trust God. But it's different when it comes to your own situation. So you're going through a trial and somebody says, "Well, now you're just going to have to believe God for this need in your life." "Okay, I'm going to believe God." Wonder what that means, to believe God. Well, now, this is just a situation when you're just going to have to walk by faith. Okay, I'm going to walk by faith. I wonder what that means. What do you do when you walk by faith? Do you dress differently? Do you wear sackcloth and ashes? Do you pray a lot? Do you fast? Of course, we're not going to ask anybody what that means because we're embarrassed to admit that we've been in the church all these years and don't know what these fundamental words mean, so we just fake it. It's sort of like I am with a lot of people. I know a lot of people. I've known them long enough, I ought to know their names. I've known them too long to ask what it is. So I just sort of fake it, you know. And you can get into trouble doing that. I was in a church a couple of weeks ago, and this fellow came up, and he looked familiar. I knew him. And I said, "Boy, it's great to see you again. Say, how long has it been since I've seen you?" He said, "I've never seen you before in my life." So I pull out that safety net that all pastors and preachers use. "Well, you know, there's somebody who looks just like you, you know." Well, what does it mean to walk with God? What does it mean when we say the Christian life is a life of faith? And we just need to trust God. To me, those words have always been kind of abstract. And to be honest with you, I've never been real good at understanding abstract ideas. Especially when I was in school, I had a hard time following abstract instructions or understanding abstract concepts, especially when it came to things like geometry and algebra and trigonometry. They seemed mighty abstract to me. But once in a while, if the teacher would turn to the board and step by step by step, carefully and deliberately would work out that problem so that I could see it being done, I could begin to grasp it. And I discovered some time ago that's what I needed with this idea of faith and trusting God. I needed to see somebody doing it. I'd like to just follow somebody around while they were going through this whole matter of walking with God and by faith, and peer over their shoulder just see, what does it mean? What does that mean? Well, the Bible has given us such a person as that. There is a person in the Bible who is the ultimate model of faith. As a matter of fact, his name almost is synonymous with faith. As a matter of fact, the very first time it is said of anybody that they believe the Lord, it is said of this man. So that we could, I guess, technically say that faith as we know it, biblical faith as we know it, began with this man. And you know of whom, of course, I'm speaking. I'm speaking of Abraham. And it is said of him in Genesis chapter 15 that he believed the Lord. And that's the first time it is ever said of anybody that they believe the Lord. And in Romans chapter 4, when Paul is talking about Abraham's faith in connection with the birth of Isaac, he ends that chapter, well, this is sort of a paraphrase, but he ends that chapter by saying, now this doesn't just apply to Abraham only, but also to us. And he's saying in so many words that if you and I can learn to believe as Abraham believed, then we can receive as Abraham received. And so God has given us a person whose shoulder we can peer over as he goes through the very acts of believing God. The Word must always become flesh, by the way. It always needs to be put into human form so we can see it in order to be able to grasp it. And so what I want to do tonight is to follow Abraham from the beginning of his faith and of his walk with God to what I would call the apex of it, or the climax of it. And there were, it seems to me, about three great crises in the life of Abraham as God brought him along in this matter of living and walking by faith. And so there are three passages we're going to be reading from tonight. And these three passages, if you're trying to take notes, will constitute the three points of the study. We're going to be reading from Genesis 12, Genesis 17, and Genesis 22. First of all, we'll begin in Genesis chapter 12, and we'll read just the first three verses. Genesis chapter 12, just the first three verses. Now, this is the first time Abraham's name appears in the Bible, except in the 11th chapter where it's a part of the genealogy. But as far as we know, these are the very first words that God ever spoke to Abraham. Now, God is starting all over with Abraham. He's creating a new race with Abraham. It's going to be a race by faith. And so now he comes to speak to Abraham. Now these words are going to have to be mighty powerful, it seems to me. They must be tremendously significant, because whatever God says to Abraham, they must be words that will somehow create faith in this man's heart, that will ignite belief in this man's heart. Now here are the very first words. Now the Lord said to Abram, leave your country and your kindred and your father's house and go into a land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now let's just read again the first verse, because that's really the only necessary verse here to understand what God is saying. Listen to these words. Again, I emphasize, these are the very first words. Well, they've got to be something. Now the Lord said to Abram, leave your country and your kindred and your father's house and go into a land that I will show you. Well, that's kind of surprising to me. The word faith doesn't even appear there, nor the word believe or trust. As a matter of fact, God doesn't even introduce himself to Abraham. You know, I would think that God, wanting to enlist Abraham in this endeavor and wanting to do something that would inspire faith in Abraham's heart, I think I would have said, hey, I'm God, trust me. But that's not what he said. He comes to Abraham, and his first words are these: Abraham, I want you to leave your country and your kindred and your father's house and go into a land that I will show you. Now, God has, without using the word faith or believe or trust, has told us what it is. Without using the words walking with God or living the Christian life, he has told us what it is. Because right here, he establishes a pattern that you're going to find repeated throughout the course of our study tonight. As a matter of fact, I think you'll find it repeated throughout the course of your own life and experience with God. Now, what is that pattern? It is this. He says, Abraham, I have a land that I want to give you, but I can't give you my land as long as you're hanging on to your land. So I want you to leave your country, your kindred, your father's house, and go into a land that I will show you. Now, in my walk with God, in your walk with God, as we grow in our faith and trust of Him, it always involves a leaving and losing and letting go of one thing so that we may take hold of something else. That's the pattern that is established there. It always involves that. It is a letting go of one thing so that we may take hold of something else. God always has for us that land, but he says, I can't give you my land until you let go of your land. You must open your hand, empty your hand of what you're holding, so that I can fill it with what I want you to have. So here it is. It is a leaving, losing, letting go of one thing so that we may take hold of something else. Now, this is not simply the pattern of the spiritual life. This is the pattern of all life, period. Because all life is a matter of leaving one thing so that you may move into something else, of letting go of one thing so that you may take hold of something else. In other words, in life, you and I grow up by giving up. That's the way it happens. That's the pattern. For instance, at the very beginning, that little baby must leave the warmth and security of that womb if it is to be born and live in the world itself. And so from the very outset, it has to leave one country to enter into another country. It has to let go of one security, of one identity, in order to move into another identity, into another security. And that's not all. I mean, that's just the beginning. For soon, eventually, that little baby must let go of the diapers and the baby bottle if it's going to wear grown-up pants and sit down and eat T-bone steak and stuff like that. I mean, you know, it's always a moving from one stage to the next stage. Eventually, it has to let go of the tricycle so it can move up to the bicycle. And then it lets go of the bicycle so it can move up to the car. Then it goes back to the bicycle, usually. But it's always moving from one stage to another. Now, here is the tough thing about growing up. You see, you get comfortable in one stage of your development. And you feel secure. And it is that security that you feel in that particular phase of your development that gives you your identity and your security. But then it comes time when God says, all right, it's time to leave this stage and move into another stage. But I don't want to do that. Why? Because I'm warm and secure here. And I know everything about this stage. And I feel comfortable here. And moving into another stage means I'm going to have to let go of some things that I don't want to let go. And it's kind of scary moving into a new phase of life. And I don't know how that phase is going to be. And it's going to be a little bit awkward and unnatural. And so we take tentative, awkward steps from one stage to another. But that's the way it is throughout all of life. Jesus said, for this reason shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife. Now what's he saying? He's saying in order to make a home, you have to leave home. And that's the way it is throughout life. What do we say of a person who refuses to leave one stage of their life and move into the next stage? We say they're immature. Why is that? Well, because folks, it's always scary to leave that stage of your life, that stage of your development, where you're settled in and unpacked and you know your way around. And now, it's time to leave that which you know and move into an area that you don't know, and it's scary and mysterious, and there's a little hesitancy about it. But if you're going to grow, you're going to have to do that. We grow up by giving up. And you know, I like I say, that's the way it is throughout all of life. My father died in 1990. My mom died in 1974. But when your last parent dies, that is something special. I mean, that's different. Because all of a sudden, you know what my thought was, Brother Paul? When my dad died, you know what I thought? Here was my thought. Now I'm standing at the front of the line. I could remember when I was a little kid and I was way back at the end of the line and there are all these big persons in front of me, these adults in front of me, you see. I was just a little kid. But as the years have gone by, they peeled off one after another. And here I am standing at the front of the line. I'm next to peel off here. I don't know that I like this position. I thought I'd always be 25 or something, you know. I'm trying to remember what it feels like to get up and walk across the room without grunting and groaning and, you know, and aching in every joint. But that's a phase. And I remember when my dad died, I realized, oh my goodness. You know, I'm cut off from a certain important part of my life. I can never, there's nobody I can go to now and ask about things that only my mother or my dad would know. And it's been 4 years and I still find myself catching myself saying once in a while, oh, I need to ask Dad about that. Well, there's no one to ask. And my brother, we were staying at my dad's house during the funeral, and a few days after the funeral, my brother, who lived just about 1,000 yards down the hill there on the same farm, he came up to the house one day. He's my older brother, and he said to me, well, little brother, it's grown-up time. And I knew what he meant. It's time to close down the house and get rid of Dad's things and go through all of his papers. Folks, that was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. Because I was closing a very important chapter on my life. But that's the natural process of life. You grow up by giving up. It's always that way. And in the Christian life, it is that way too. God says, I have this for you. I have this degree of knowledge. I have this level of commitment. I have this level of understanding. But you cannot leave it. You cannot enter into it until you're willing to leave what you've already experienced. And if you hang on to that and refuse to let go of that, you can never move on and grow up and mature in the Lord. It is a leaving, losing, and letting go of one thing so that you may move on to something else. So God comes to Abraham and he says, Abraham, I want to make of you a new nation. I want to make of you a new people. But I can't do it where you are. Because, you see, that land in which you live, that's the land that's what gives you your security. That's what gives you your identity. You're a wealthy man. You're well established there. But I want to take you into new frontiers that you've never before even imagined existed. But I can't do it until you're willing to walk away from that which you've always known, that which you've always believed, that which you've always experienced, and are willing to trust me and let me lead you into a new life, into a new land. Now the writer of Hebrews says that God spoke to Abraham, and when God called him, Abraham got up and went out, not knowing where he was going. I think that could well be the theme song of the Christian life, going without knowing. You see, the Christian life is really a life traveling under sealed orders, because we never really know where God is going to lead us. We think we know, but we never really know where God is going to lead us. By the way, I have to mention that I have great respect for Sarah, Abraham's wife, on this point. You think about that for a minute. Here's Abraham, a wealthy man, well established, and he comes home one evening and he says, oh, by the way, Sarah, you may want to pack a suitcase tonight. Well, whatever for, Abraham? Well, we're leaving in the morning. She said, where are we going? I don't know. Well, how long are we going to be gone? Well, I'm not sure, but I think forever. Abraham, where'd you get such a notion? Well, you know, it's the funniest thing. I was out today, and a voice spoke to me out of heaven, told me to do this. Now, I'll tell you something. Not many wives go with their husbands on that kind of condition, but she did. They went out not knowing where they were going. I used to think, why didn't God tell Abraham the destination? That would seem to be an important piece of information Abraham ought to have. Because what if he and God get separated on the journey? Well, if God is the only one who knows where you're going, and you get separated from him, you're lost. So I used to think, you know, it would have been a good idea if God had told Abraham his destination. Now, I'm in a different church every week, and sometimes after the service or some of the pastors say, now we're going across town over here to eat or do this, and said, you follow me. Well, it always makes me a little nervous to follow a Baptist preacher in heavy traffic, you see. I mean, my first thought is, if he goes through on yellow, I've got to go through on red. And we were following Brother Paul out to where we were staying last night, and the light turned yellow, and Kay said, oh, good, he stopped on yellow. We don't have to go through on red, because we've done it many a time. Why? He's the only one that knows where we're going. If I lose sight of him, I'm lost. Maybe that's why God didn't tell Abraham the destination. Maybe if Abraham had known the destination, he would have fixed his eyes on the destination. But if God's the only one who knows where you're going, you'd better make certain that your eyes are fixed on God and that you let nothing come between you and your vision of God, you see. Because if you lose sight of him, you're lost, period. And I believe the Christian life is always a going without knowing. And folks, that's scary. I'm going to be honest with you. There's a great deal of risk in living this life. And a great deal that is mysterious and unknown. Because God rarely, if ever, reveals to us the destination. I guess that's why Moses made his strange request of the Lord. You remember when Moses went up to get the law on the, from God, by the time he got back down to the people, they'd already broke every one of them. And so Moses went back up there and he found out that not only was he upset, but God was even more upset. And God said, Moses, I don't want you to pray for this bunch. I'm through with them. I've had it with them. They're a stiff-necked, stubborn people. I'm going to let them die here in the wilderness. I'm going to start all over with you, Moses. That's a pretty good deal when you get to thinking about it, you see. Nobody will talk about the faith of Abraham. They'll talk about the faith of Moses. They'll not call Abraham the father. They'll call Moses the father. I'm going to start all over with you, Moses. And Moses began to pray and said, God, you can't do that. Oh, God, you can't do that. And he gave him two reasons. Number one, he said, first of all, God, if you do this, you'll ruin your reputation. People will say, the only reason he delivered them from Egypt was to kill them out in the wilderness. He said, you can't do that. You'll give your enemies reason to mock. The second reason, he said, if you do this, Lord, you'll be breaking your word to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob because you promised them that you would lead them into the land. So the Bible says, and this is where the King James has one of these quaint little statements. It says, and the Lord repented of the evil he intended to do his people. Now what that means is God changed his mind. He said, well, God doesn't change his mind. I know that. But God changed his mind and he said to Moses, all right, Moses, I'll not destroy the people. Now get back down there and saddle up and lead that bunch into the promised land. And I think that's when Moses realized he had overprayed his hand. I don't think he wanted to be the pastor of that bunch, you see. Who would want to be the pastor of that bunch? I think he prayed for their deliverance and interceded that God would fulfill his word, but I don't think Moses had any aspirations to lead that bunch at this point. God said, you're the leader. And then Moses made a strange request. Do you remember what he asked of God? He said, Lord, show me your face. Show me your face. Now, what is he asking? Well, I can't help but think that maybe Moses is asking the Lord this. He's saying, you know, God, you're wanting me to commit my life to lead this bunch. It would really be a help and encouragement to me if I could see your face, if you and I could sort of have a sit down and a face-to-face meeting, and I'd kind of like to know what's up front. I'd sort of like to be in on what you're up to and what's going on. You reckon you and I could see your face? I'm tired of this mystery. I'd like to see your face. And God said, can't do that. No man can see my face and live, but I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put you in the cleft of the rock, and I'll place my hand over your face, and as I pass by, I'll withdraw my hand, and you can see me from my back. And so that's what he did. He put Moses in the cleft of the rock, put his hand over the face of that servant, and as God passed by Moses, he removed his hand, and the Bible says that Moses saw God from the back. I'm pretty much convinced that's the only way we see God in this life, is from the back. You say, what do you mean? Well, for me, about the only way I ever really see God is in retrospect, from the back. To tell you the truth, most of the time when I look out in front of me, I don't see God there. As a matter of fact, what I see is confusing. I mean, I'm supposed to be following God, and I've had all these preconceived ideas of what it really means to follow God and how much fun it is to follow God and how nice and easy it is to follow God. But I'm looking at this path that I'm on, and I want to tell you something, folks. This looks like the wrong path to me. I mean, this road that I'm on is full of potholes and curves and hills, and it's got traps and snares along the way and hedged about with thorns. And to tell you the truth, there's not any light. I can't see where I'm going. And I don't see God anywhere. I mean, I'm looking at my life and I'm looking at the things that I'm facing. I'm looking in the direction that I'm moving. And I don't see God in any of these situations. I mean, I don't make sense. I can't see any sense. And I must have zigged when I should have zagged. I made a wrong turn. I've missed God somewhere. But every once in a while, you stop and you turn around and you look back over the road you come, and you know it looks a lot different when you look back. No, when you look back over it, the road is as straight as an arrow and well lighted, and there are no traps and no snares and no thorns, and my goodness, you see God all over the place. You know, I have to say to you tonight that in retrospect and looking back on my life, especially the last few years, I can see God everywhere. At the time, I couldn't see Him anywhere. And I kept wondering if somehow I had missed God. And I kept looking for somebody who may have had the same experience as I'd seen. But the trouble is, I kept running into people who were filled with this brimming confidence that they knew what they were doing. And I want to say, where did you get this great confidence? You seem to know exactly what you're doing. I don't know what I'm doing. I think I know what I'm doing, but then when I start to do it, I think I don't know what I'm doing because nothing's working out like it's supposed to work out. And I keep looking for people who, are you lost too? Well, if they are, they won't admit it. They always say, oh, I know right where I am. But when I look back in retrospect, my goodness, I could kick myself for missing God. Well, sure, I see God here, I see God here, I see God there. Now I know why God had me here. Now I know why God had me here. Now this makes sense. This whole situation right over here that seemed to be totally confused at the time, now it makes perfect sense because in retrospect, I see God everywhere. But usually in following Him, I'm going without knowing. That was the first great crisis that came to Abraham. I think that's the first great crisis that comes to all of us. There's a worldly connection we have to break. There is an island of security. There is a land of identity that we have to be willing to let go of and move into where God can take us deeper with Himself and take us into new realms of knowledge of Himself. But you see, the trouble is we become satisfied with where we are, what we know, what we've grown up with, and what everybody else agrees to. I mean, everybody there in the Ur of the Chaldees agreed that this was the right thing to do. This was the best place to live. Only a fool would strike out like Abraham did. So that was the first great crisis. The second great crisis in the life of Abraham comes in Genesis chapter 17. In Genesis chapter 17. Now, and folks, y'all are going to have to listen a lot faster than you're listening if we're going to finish on time, which we never do. But you remember the promise that God made to Abraham? He made Abraham this tremendous promise. He said, Abraham, you and Sarah are going to have a son, and out of this son shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. What a tremendous promise. Well, having made that promise, God did what He was wont to do in those days. He disappeared for about a generation. But He left with a great promise. Only one thing wrong. It didn't work. Sarah, and surely God was not aware of this at the time He made the promise, Sarah was not able to bear children. Impossible. Well, the years are ticking by and time is passing, and what are they going to do? You can see the panic rising in them because, I mean, God is depending upon us. We're the only team God has on the field. If we let God down, the whole scheme of world redemption is lost forever. He is depending upon us to bring Him a son. And so one day Sarah says, well, I tell you what, you could take Hagar, my handmaiden, and go in and lie with her and have a son of her. And so Abraham did that, of course, at Sarah's suggestion. Of course, later on, Sarah gets mad at him and says to him, it's all your fault. She forgets that it was her idea to do this. But anyway, he goes in and lies with Hagar, and Hagar brings forth a son, and they call him Ishmael. And oh my goodness, aren't they glad when Ishmael was born? I'm going to try it one more time. No, I'm going to try it one more time. And now, here's what you have to understand. The moment Ishmael was born, as far as Abraham was concerned, the promise was fulfilled. Everything God had promised, that was it. Done deal. What a relief. Boy, it was nip and tuck there for a while. Looked like we were going to let God down, but old Hagar came through, and now we've got our son, and world redemption will be back on track now. Ishmael. Well, one day when Ishmael was 14 years old, 14 years old. For 14 years, Abraham had believed the promise was fulfilled. Abraham's out walking one day, and guess who shows up again? Right, God. And you know what God does? He takes up right where he left off years ago. Nobody has informed God as to what's happened in the meantime. And he takes up right where he left off and repeats the same old won't work promise. Listen to what he says. Chapter 17, verse 15. God said to Abraham, "As for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall her name be. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall give rise to nations. Kings of people shall come from her." Verse 17, then Abraham fell on his face, and that was the proper thing to do. If God begins to boom to you from out of heaven, it's a good idea to fall on your face out of reverence and respect and worship. Well, he did that, but he also got the giggles. He said, then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, now I tell you how I picture Abraham doing this. You know how it is when you're in school or Sunday school or something, and the teacher says something funny that's not supposed to be funny, but you laugh and you know you're in trouble if you laugh out loud, so you hold your nose to keep from laughing and burst your eardrums. It's that kind of laughter. There is Abraham down there on his face trying to be reverential and respectful towards God, but God has just said the most ridiculous thing he's ever heard in his life. He said, "This, I can't believe this. Shall a man who's 100 years old give birth to a son, and shall Sarah, who's 90 years old..." You know, he said, "I'm as good as dead. I'm 100 years old. Sarah, as far as bearing children is concerned, has always been dead. She's never been able to bear children." He said, "This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life." And he cries out and says, "Oh God, that Ishmael might live before you." God says no. "But Sarah shall bear thee a son, and thou shalt call his name Isaac." Now, remember the pattern? God says, "Abraham, I have the child of promise for you, but I can't give him to you as long as you're hanging on to Ishmael. You've got to let go of Ishmael before I can give you Isaac." Why? Because every walk with God, every step of faith with God is a letting go of one thing so that we may take hold of something else. And here is a man who for 14 years has lived under the illusion that everything was just like it ought to be. And that's hard to give up. And so when God says we're going to do it this way, he cries out, "Oh God, that Ishmael might live before thee." Now, what does Ishmael represent? Now, I know that in the Bible, sometimes Ishmael represents the law as opposed to grace, and sometimes it represents the works of the flesh as opposed to the work of the Spirit. But I'm talking about, what does Ishmael mean to Abraham personally? What was Ishmael to Abraham? Well, let me put it like this. I believe that Ishmael is my version of God's will for my life. Ishmael is where my vision collides with God's vision. Ishmael is where my plan and my dreams run head on into God's plan and God's dream. You say, we all have our dreams, we all have our vision. I have my version of how my life is supposed to be. And there's not anything wrong with that, because from the earliest years as we grow up, we begin to dream and plan. And we, man, you know, I know what my life, I know what I want my life to be, man. I can picture it. I dream about it, what I want to be when I grow up. And I dream about, well, I know the kind of person I want to be, and I know what I want to be vocationally. And I can see the kind of wife that I want to have, or the kind of husband. And I can see my family. I'd like to have 4 children, 2 boys, 2 girls. That's nice. 2 of each. That's the kind of family I want to have. And that's my dream. And I can see the house. I know where I want to live. And I can see my house. I know exactly the kind of house I want to have. And I've got my life planned out. And this is the way, this is my dream. I mean, I've grown up with this dream. And when God called me into the ministry, this is the dream that I brought to it. I said, I know exactly what God wants me to do. And I know because this is what I want to be and what I want to do. And so we all have our dreams. We grow up with them. Let me ask you, is there anybody here tonight over the age of 25 that can stand up and say, "Preacher, I have never had to at least one time, I have never had to at least one time change any of my dreams or adjust any of my plans"? No. Because life is not a fulfilling of your plans and dreams. It is an adjusting of those plans and dreams to meet God's will. But I don't want to give up Ishmael. No, sir. No, I don't want to give up Ishmael. Boy, no, Lord. Oh, God, don't make me do this. This is what I've always wanted. This is what I've always dreamed. This is what I want my kids to be. This is what I've always dreamed they grew up to be. And Lord, you're saying to me, you've got different plans. And Lord, this is not what I had in mind when we started out. And now you're telling me that I've got to let go of my dreams and my visions. And you're telling me that I've got to let go of Ishmael because Ishmael, well, that's not your doing. That's my doing. But you see, if I'm ever going to know the fullness of God's promise, I've got to be willing to give up my Ishmael. Let go of my Ishmael. But Abraham finds that difficult to do, so he cries out and says, "Oh God, that Ishmael might live before thee." Now what's he saying there? I think what Abraham is doing, and I think he's trying to do it as delicately and as diplomatically as he can, I think he's trying to steer God into a more reasonable course of action. You know what he's saying when he says that Ishmael may live before you? You know what he's saying? He's saying, "God, let's do it my way. After all, that's what I'm most comfortable with. Let's do it my way." And I can see him, he calls Ishmael over and says, "God, I want you to take a look at this boy. Come over here, Ishmael. Look at this boy. Look at those eyes. Have you ever seen, look at those piercing eyes. Have you ever seen any more true eyes than that? Look at those teeth. Open your mouth, Ishmael. Show God those teeth. Look how strong he is. Look at the muscle tone on this young man. I tell you what, God, I believe we ought to go with what we got. I want to tell you something now. Sarah is pretty iffy on this proposition of having children, and it seems to me that we've got a good young man right here, and he meets all the qualifications, and I tell you what, Lord, I think I'd feel more comfortable going with a sure thing." And of course, you're always in danger when you insist on going with a sure thing, which is the opposite of going without knowing. God says no, but Ishmael, going to let him go. But Sarah shall bear thee a son. Thou shalt call his name Isaac. And for the first time we discover that it wasn't Abraham or Sarah that named Isaac, but it was God. Now somebody tell me, what does the name Isaac mean? Yes, laughter. Laughter. There's Abraham down there on his face laughing at God, said, "This will never work." God says, "I tell you what, Abraham, we're going to do it my way, like it or not. And by the way, let's name that boy Laughter. And that way, every time you see him, you'll remember that you laughed at me today. And every time you call his name out, you'll remember that you laughed at me today. Let's call him Laughter." Which leads us to the last great crisis in Abraham's life of faith. Genesis chapter 22. We'll read just the first two verses. After these things, now you have to go back and say, what things? Well, you look back in the preceding chapters and you'll find that we're coming to the end of a series of events and blessings in which God gave His wholehearted support for Abraham. I mean, Abraham is living on top of the mountain. He's on a roll. You see, right now, you would think that everything is going Abraham's way. And after all of these signs of God's blessings and favor, comes this unexpected turn of events. After these things, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." He said, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I will show you." You may take Isaac. and offer him as sacrifice. Yes. Lord, you know, Lord, when you told me that I had to leave my land, I thought that killed me. But I can see now that that was the best thing to do. I could never have heard your voice. You could never have had the influence on me as long as I was living in that world. And you were right. It was the right thing to do. I can see that now. But Lord, could I remind you that Isaac was your idea? I mean, I didn't want him in the first place, you understand? I mean, I was happy with Ishmael. I wanted Ishmael, but you said, oh no, we can't have Ishmael, we've got to have Isaac. And so I broke my heart and gave up Ishmael, and you gave me Isaac because that's what you wanted, not what I wanted. And so I took Isaac, and now he's become the apple of my eye and the treasure of my heart, and now I am bound to him by cords of love, and now all of a sudden you come and you tell me to sacrifice him. Lord, I don't understand what you're up to. I don't know. Lord, what do you want from me? When are you going to leave me alone? How much is enough? I do everything you want me to do to get me where you want me to be. And the minute I get there, then all of a sudden, you do this to me. I don't understand. It's not like Isaac was my idea. It's not like Isaac was something I came up with. Isaac is your idea. Isaac is what you gave me. Isaac is your hope, not my hope. He's your hope. I don't understand. It's like that mother of two small girls who came to me in a meeting, and she said, Brother Dunn, said, after my husband and I got married, God called him into the ministry. She said, I went back to work, put him through college. I continued to work while we had babies and put him through seminary because this is what God wanted. And when he finished seminary, we both felt God wanted him to go on and do his PhD work. And she said, I continued for years to work. We struggled, we sacrificed, we scrimped to get by, to get to where God wanted us to be. And finally, one day, he earned his PhD, and 2 weeks later, he was dead. And she said, I don't understand. I mean, we were doing what God wanted us to do. And when we finally got to where God wanted us to get, then all of this. She said, I don't understand. Or it reminds me of a young seminary student who said to me, he said, you know, I'm not asking for God's help. I'm just asking for God to stop bothering me. And he was very serious because he didn't understand. He said, I'm trying to live for God. I'm trying to get through this education. I'm trying to be everything God wants me to be. And God just throws one barrier after another into my way. And I don't understand. I've stopped asking him for help. All I'm asking him now is just not to hinder me in my effort to do what he wants me to do. You know what he said to me? He said, I believe in God, but I don't trust him. Well, anathema on that young man. Nobody's ever felt like that. No, the fact is, folks, sometimes it seems as though God Himself... Well, let me put it this way. He comes and He says, Abraham, right, I want you to take Isaac. Now, that's enough. He could have stopped right there, but He didn't. He says, I want you to take Isaac, your only son, Isaac, whom thou lovest. I get the picture, Lord. I know who you're talking about. You see, it's as though God is not just plunging the knife, but He's twisting it and offering there as a sacrifice. Now, let me ask you a question. What's all this about? What is all this about? Well, I tell you what it's about. You read on into that chapter, and there is Abraham with Isaac strapped to the altar and his arm raised to plunge that dagger into the heart of his son. And the voice from heaven says, stay thy hand, do thy son no wrong or harm. For now I see that you will withhold nothing from me. You see, the truth of the matter is, until God had Isaac, he didn't have all of Abraham there was to have. Now let me watch it now. What if God says, Abraham, I want you to sacrifice Isaac to me as an act of worship? Abraham said, not going to do it. You know what he's saying? He's saying, God, I love you, but I love your gift better. Lord, I'm committed to You, but I'm more committed to what You've given me than I am to You. You see, Abraham has no choice really in this matter. If he withholds Isaac from God, he is admitting that he thinks more of the gift than the giver and loves the blessing more than he loves the blesser. Basically, what God is saying to Abraham, to me, to you, is that possession is an ownership. You may possess something, but that doesn't mean you own it. And you see, the trouble we get into is great when we come to think that what we possess is ours. You say, well, it's my life. No, you possess it, but you don't own it. And God can show you that real quickly. You say, it's my money. No, you may possess it, but you don't own it. And God can show you that real quickly. You say, they're my kids. No, you possess them, but you don't own them. And they'll show you that soon enough. Possession is not ownership. If I'm not willing to take the best, it's not enough for me to walk away from the world and to give up the works of the flesh and all of that. If I'm not willing to take the best, the good, the perfect, that which God has given, and put it in the altar and say, Lord, You mean more to me than all of this You've given me, then God doesn't have all of me there is to have. In 1969, we had a man come to our church in a meeting. His name was John Hunter. He used to work with Major Ian Thomas and Cape and Ray and all of that. And I'd heard him on several occasions. And so I said, the next time you come to the States, I want you to come to my church. Well, he came in January of 1969. But he brought his wife, Christine, with him. I'd never met her. Now, she was a different horse of another color. I'm going to tell you something. Christine, while John was very gentle and quiet, and Christine was a salty old dog. I mean, she was something else. Well, the three of us, John and Christine and myself, and this was in 1969. I was, you know how young I was. I was just a kid. And we were in my study there praying for the service. And we finished and we got up and left. And John went out the door first, followed by his wife Christine, followed by me. Well, when Mrs. Hunter got in the doorway, she suddenly stopped and turned around. I remember this is the first time she's met me. And she looks at me and stares me in the eye and puts her hand on my arm and she says, young man, hold all things loosely. I said, yes, ma'am. And I didn't have a clue as to what that woman was talking about. But I have never forgotten those words. Hold all things loosely. I think I know what she's talking about now. You see, if you get too tight a grip on anything as though it's yours, and God says, I want you to let go of that. You're grasping it too tightly. It's becoming too important to you. Let go. I can't. My hands are cramped into a locked fist. I can't let go. Hold all things loosely. You see, God never intended that Isaac should die up there on that mountain. The Bible says it was a test. Now, Abraham didn't know it was a test, of course. Abraham thought the boy was going to die, or else it wouldn't have been a test. But it was never God's intention that Abraham should die, or that Isaac should die. It was Abraham that should die, you see, die to Isaac. Well, back in the early 70s, there happened into our family life a certain trial. And it was the greatest trial that we had ever faced. One day we were talking about it, Kay and I, my wife and I. And I said something that I thought sounded spiritual. I mean, it sounded, you know, martyr-like. You know what I said to her? I said, well, honey, you know, the only thing that I'm worrying about is the effect this will have on my ministry. Now, doesn't that sound selfless? I mean, you know, the only thing I'm worrying about is the effect this will have on my ministry. And Kay said, on whose ministry? I said, on my ministry. She said, on whose ministry? I said, on my And then I remembered that a few weeks before I'd been preaching out of 2 Corinthians over there where Paul talks about the ministry we have received. And I made a big deal about it not being our ministry, but it being God's ministry. Boy, I tell you, if there's anything that bugs me anymore, I don't know what it is, than to have God and Kay preach old sermons to me. You mean the only thing you're worried about is your ministry? Yes. Folks, it's not your ministry. Oh, but it is. No. I'm not careful, that ministry God's given me is going to be more important to me than the God who gave it to me. Are you telling me, preacher, that a preacher can make an idol out of his ministry? Oh, yes. Don't you read the papers? No, until God has my Isaac, folks, He doesn't have all of me there is to have. Hold all things loosely, because possession is not ownership. Well, you've been good listeners. Oh, there is one thing that I need to mention. Do you realize that this is the only time that God has not given Abraham a promise of a reward? He said, if you'll leave your land, I'll give you my land. Oh, well, that sweetens the deal. That makes it a little bit easier to take. It's going to be hard to leave my land, but knowing I'm going to get a better land, I can handle that. He says, let go of Ishmael, and I'll give you Isaac. Well, it's going to rip my heart out to get rid of Ishmael, but knowing that I'm going to get Isaac, helps a little bit. But this time, when he says, I want you to sacrifice Isaac, there is no promise. Now, the writer of Hebrews says that Abraham knew God could raise him from the dead, but God didn't say he was. And as I said, if it's to be a real test, Abraham has to believe that Isaac is going to die. There is no promise, which makes me sort of believe that maybe the greatest kind of faith is all. It's the kind of faith that obeys God and trusts God without promise of a reward. But you do it just because it's God, and He alone is worthy and worth it, you see. Oh, there is one other thing, though. I do believe that there was a reward, because several thousand years later, you remember one day Jesus was talking to a bunch of Pharisees, and He said, Abraham rejoiced to see my day and was glad. And you know what I think happened? I believe that day when Abraham loosened Isaac from that altar, I believe God pulled aside the curtains of future eternity and gave Abraham a glimpse of the true Isaac that would one day come. And I don't know, somehow I have the idea that the truest glimpse I ever get of Jesus is when I've got my Isaac on the altar. So that's what faith is. That's what walking with God is. It's letting go of one thing so that we may take hold of something else. We grow up by giving up. And it is going without knowing, coming to the place where God Himself means more to us than anything He's given us.